welcome to another episode of Free Lunch by the Peak, the podcast where we talk to people way smarter than us about the most important topics in Canadian business, economics, and policy. I'm your co-host, Taylor Scollin. Sarah Bartnicka is off this week. So last week, the federal budget was released, and it's a massive document, 400 plus pages that outlines $53 billion in new spending and hundreds of policy changes. And I've always been curious how something like this comes together. How does the federal budget actually get made? What goes into coming up with the ideas that go into it and then translating those into policy? What's the actual process behind the scenes for developing one of, if not the most important policy documents in the country? And my guest this week is Tyler Meredith, and there very well may be nobody in the country more familiar with how the federal budget works and is developed than Tyler, because he's helped create six of them as a top economic advisor to Prime Minister Trudeau and two finance ministers. But not this one, however. He's now in the private sector as a partner at Meredith Bosanquil. But he's been generous enough to join us today and share his insights from what he learned during his time in government. So Tyler, thank you so much for joining us on Free Lunch.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I want to get into the budget from last week and how that's put together. But before we do that, I think it would be good to talk a little bit about what your role was in the federal government, because I think it's important context for people to understand the perspective that you're coming from. Can you just talk a little bit about what you did in the federal government over the past few years?
So there's, if you think about a budget, there's like three groups that are involved. There's the public service and primarily the folks at finance and the prime minister's office. There's the prime minister and the minister of finance as the deciders. And then there's the people who advise those two decision makers. And so I was in the latter category. I was an economic advisor in the prime minister's office from 2015 until the end of, near the end of 2022, and also in finance. And so on kind of both sides of the table, I was involved in about six different budgets, and over that period of time, got to understand the fiscal framework very well. So I'm really interested in this conversation.
And I think one more sort of table setting question, you know, when people think of a budget, I think everyone has a budget that they live by to manage their own household finances, but a government's budget is a little bit different than that. So what are the key differences that people should keep in mind when we're having this conversation?
So it's probably important to state that there's no official requirement to table a budget. It is just simply an exercise that we do, and it's a convention that we do at least once a year. Sometimes in a few cases, there's been budgets more than once a year, but effectively once a year, an outline of what the government intends to do with the money that it will eventually ask Parliament to appropriate. And we have to separately go to Parliament to appropriate money. We can't on our own just announce a statement in the budget and do something. We have to go through a separate legislative process to go and get money. But what the budget does is it tells people, here's what we think is happening in the economy. Here's how that is changing government finance. Here's what we intend to do as new priorities or a change in priorities over the course of the next year. And increasingly, this has been true over the last several decades. Beyond just those objectives, it's also the kind of master political document of the government for the year, because it brings together all the different policy processes that happen and indicates kind of what we're doing, not just in terms of spending money, but even sometimes if they require regulatory changes or an announcement of an intention to institute a new program, again, which may or may not require funding, because it is the main opportunity that the government has in one point in time in a year to tell people the entirety of what the government's agenda is.
I think that's a good jumping off point to how these things actually get put together. So where does this process begin? Who comes up with those big ideas that the government wants to pursue? And you know, at what point do those start to get discussed in terms of something that's going to end up in a budget?
So usually sometime in the early fall, there is a kickoff to the kind of planning season for the year that happens when cabinet does a retreat at the end of the summer, beginning of the fall. And at that point in time, the Minister of Finance will usually give an update of what they're seeing in the economy and how people going into the planning session should think about issues that is going to be on the government's radar. That then triggers a process where the minister goes out and surveys all of their colleagues to get input on the things that their colleagues, i.e. the ministers in the cabinet, would want to undertake. And those proposals that come back to the Minister of Finance could be anything from stuff that has been in a government platform, in a mandate letter, or they could be entirely new stuff, or even things that are kind of just the ordinary stuff of making government work, right? We need to increase, for example, maintenance on certain government buildings because things may be falling apart. We need to invest in new technology because our EI system has old mainframe computers that have been they've been running on since the 1960s. You get all of those different proposals. You lay them out on a table, and effectively that can come to sometimes about 300 or 400 different items of proposals. You add all of those things up, there may be potentially, you know, $100 billion or $200 billion worth of proposed spending measures. Obviously, you don't in a budget have usually the space to do all those things. So you then got to decide, well, what is the stuff that I actually want to look at? Because the thing about the budget process is it's really a discrete strategic planning process of time, right? As anyone who's ever done strategic planning knows, you have to have a sense of what is important at the outset that you do or don't want to look at, while still trying to kind of be a bit open-ended and creative about where things could go. So usually once you've gotten those responses back, you'll whittle that down. You'll throw out 50 to 100 different items that you know you're never going to look at. And then once you've got that kind of universe of ideas, you have to then decide between finance and PMO and between the prime minister and the finance minister, what are the things that might be missing from this that you want to talk about? Is your agenda, is your political agenda changing, right? So over the course of the last year, we've really seen housing issues and affordability issues take front and center. It's not surprising, therefore, that this past budget was really about some of those questions, particularly intergenerational fairness questions in the housing market, right? So they would have said early on in that budget process, I want to see a comprehensive housing plan. And you would be driving the decision-making process towards having proposals that meet that objective. And then the last two things that you need to do is you need to go out and survey a bunch of economists. The Department of Finance uses a universe of economists that they've been surveying for the last kind of 30 years. And that gives you a baseline of inputs around how the economy is going to change over the next 5 years across 10 or 12 different variables like CPI, like nominal GDP, like the West Texas Intermediate oil price, et cetera. And that creates a fiscal baseline. And then once you have that baseline and you've decided what your priorities are, you figure out what is your availability of room to spend or not. And then you just make decisions. You start to review each particular decision note because everything that you want to look at needs, as we would call it in the business, a two-pager. They're not usually two pages. They're usually much longer than that. And you just make decisions. And the Minister of Finance makes a decision, and then it gets forwarded to the Prime Minister, and they make a decision. And you sometimes have to go back through the process again to revise as you start to see how far off you are from your trajectory. But that's a process that takes about 5 to 6 months as it fully rolls out. And you arrive somewhere at the end of late March or early April, and you've got a budget.
Okay, when you're in the the phase of coming up with ideas that are going to perhaps make their way into the final budget, how much of that would you say is driven by cabinet ministers, and how much of it would you say is driven by maybe the Prime Minister's office and finance? Is it more of a top-down exercise or a bottom-up exercise?
It's a bit of both, but it really starts from the Prime Minister's office and the Finance Minister deciding what are the intentional thematics of what they want to emphasize in a budget, and then working back against, okay, from the initial set of stuff that I have received out of the process when I surveyed my cabinet colleagues, have they given me enough things to answer these thematics that I can demonstrate that we've got what it takes to solve some of these problems? And if we don't, then what often happens is you'll start to bring in outside voices and you'll be engaging with experts. You'll be talking obviously to caucus members who aren't cabinet ministers because they may have priorities that are different than cabinet. You'll want to be doing some polling. So it's actually a multifaceted input process of which ministers are kind of just one input into that process. And it's interesting because once a minister puts forward an idea, that's it. Like, they can do some internal lobbying, but they don't know what's going to happen through the budget process. They're not consulted on the design of something because they can't be, right? Because they can be, in some cases, advocates of their own specific thing that they want to achieve, which sometimes when you have to take on the perspective of a prime minister or a finance minister, you have to have the perspective of the whole government, of what is in the best interest of the whole government. And sometimes you can't satisfy everybody. And that's why those ministers in some ways have to become their own internal advocates, the same way stakeholders on the outside are pushing for things that they want to see.
Okay, interesting. I'm also curious about this group of economists that feed in for the forecasting piece yep. of a budget. Where do those people come from? You know, how is that group of people put together? And I guess, does the composition of that group change over time? Because it seems like a pretty important part of a budget is coming up with some sort of accurate baseline.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, the budget is in some ways what I call a taker of the economy, right? It doesn't actually get to set, at least in the way that the federal government does it, it doesn't get to set its own judgment about what it thinks is going to change in the economy. Now, at the provincial level, some provinces do it differently. They will come up with their own internal forecast, and then they'll have to validate whether that forecast stands up by credibility to what the private market thinks is a reasonable outlook. But the benefit of this particular approach, which was an approach that was introduced in the 1990s when the government under Paul Martin tried to enhance, in a sense, the fiscal credibility of the government by putting in place a series of things that politically you couldn't play with, one being the forecast, another being certain fiscal rules around the use of surpluses and so forth. What that has done is it means that the Department of Finance is substituting its view for the view of the average of the market, right? And so there is a population of institutions. It's not just some random group that changes from year to year. It's the same institutions. And it's not even the people. It's the institutions. So all of the big five banks, a couple of the large pension funds, a few insurance companies, the University of Toronto even has a chief economist who submits to the process. You can find the list of all the names in Annex 1 of every budget document. And you can even online take a look at what has been the average of the forecast that they have put in. And they're asked to give their views on, as I say, about 10 or 12 different variables over a number of quarters, over a number of years. But the consequence of that exercise, which, by the way, the Department of Finance continues to do throughout the year, it isn't just in the budget process, they do this on a quarterly basis. The consequence of that exercise is that if the market is more or less optimistic or pessimistic than you as a policymaker may be, doesn't matter what you think. It's you have to take the average of what they have told you. And so if they think that interest rates are going to under or overshoot, you have to hold that kind of, you have to be a taker on that particular view and how that plays into things like debt charges or how that plays into things like GDP. And there's a huge impact that how economists' input to that process have on the rest of the budget, because those inputs, which create an average baseline, then establishes, based on historical patterns, the relationship between, say, revenue and GDP, right? So it gives us an estimate going forward of what we think our forward views should be about future revenues. And there have been times, and we saw this, you know, very early on in the shift from COVID through to the rate hiking cycle in 2022, where the street was thinking that interest rates were going to top out somewhere around 2.5%. They ultimately went to 5%. And you can imagine that the difference between 2.5 and 5 has a massive impact on what you think your carrying charges will be for debt.
Yeah. Do you, when you're crafting the budget, do you feel like you have a pretty good sense of how, based on these economic forecasts, markets are going to react? Or, you know, is there still some question marks about, say, if we spend X amount, you know, the credit rating might get iffy, or we might see movement in bond markets? Like, does that ever come into play, or do you feel pretty confident in those projections?
So absolutely, when you create your fiscal track, when as I said earlier in the process, the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister set out what their desired goals will be. So Minister Freeland has talked a lot about fiscal anchors, right? She wants deficit and debt to GDP to be falling over time. She wants to ensure that we get to a deficit that's below 1% of GDP. She wants to maintain Canada being or having the lowest deficit in debt to GDP in the G7. She wants to make sure that the deficit as a dollar number is below $40 billion. The reason that she set those fiscal anchors and the reason that you have to, as a finance minister, kind of ultimately try to match your performance against those fiscal anchors is because more or less a finance minister is judged on the credibility of their fiscal plan in relation to what they said it would be in the last time that they published it, right? And so you're watching very closely to look at, are you giving the market an indication that they can trust your numbers, that they're not wildly off, that if they have been off, that you've done the work necessary to try to bring them back into line, and that the composition of spending looks reasonable given the particular outlook of the economy. Those are all things that, you know, we look at as public commentators when we judge finance ministers, but they're also the same things that credit rating agencies look at. And one of the things that every finance minister cares about is how credit rating agencies are going to react. That's not something that the average public particularly cares about, but, you know, even the words that are used in those credit rating agency reports are very important because they tell you how you're going to be judged and marked, right? So one of the things that's interesting, I'll just underline this for about 30 more seconds because I think it's a point that your listeners may not have heard before, is that if you look at some of these credit rating agency reports, one of the things they've often pointed to about Canada is to say, well, look, on a just a debt load basis, you know, we have some concerns about where Canada's headed, but we're more concerned actually about private household debt than we are public debt. But to the extent that we think that Canada maybe isn't as entitled to a AAA credit status as some other countries might be, one of the things that gives us continued confidence in Canada and why we think Canada should stand out relative to its peers in terms of how we mark its debt is because of the quality of our public institutions. It's because of the quality of the independence of the Bank of Canada. It's because we know that over time, when the Department of Finance produces a budget, it's generally a credible document that will be that the government will take seriously and try to implement. And so those qualitative factors about how well a public service is functioning actually matter quite a bit because that affects our credit rating and that in turn affects the interest, to a certain extent, the way in which or the cost at which government debt is priced and how that then feeds into how all of us pay for things like our mortgage.
That's really interesting. So once you have this list of policy ideas or things that you want to see in the budget, how do those then get translated into specific changes? So, you know, if we take the latest budget, for example, the changes to the capital cost allowance for rental apartment building construction, how does something like that get generated? Is that come from a ministry? Does that come from external stakeholders typically?
So every proposal that is ultimately actioned in the budget process has an underlying decision note, as I said earlier. And that decision note has a bunch of research behind it. And it will be based on a proposal that may come from a sponsoring ministry. So in this case, as you mentioned, it could be Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. Although because it's a tax change, often that will come from the Department of Finance itself. You have to remember the Department of Finance itself is also an advocate in this process because it runs tax policy branch. It runs the financial sector policy branch. So anything in the budget that touches the tax system in some way, and there's a lot of things that touch the tax system in terms of how we either give money to people or take money from people, that's actually the policy thinking on that's going to come from the Department of Finance, not from other parts of government. And that's, I think, a nuance that some people don't understand. But what I would say to you is that for stuff that is where it's hitting a thematic that the government has proactively set, right? So in this case, we were talking about housing. To be honest, a lot of those ideas, especially if they're top billing in the budget, a lot of those ideas usually will come not from a sponsoring department, but from the central agencies themselves that are involved in the budget process, i.e. PMO or finance, because they've made a decision, we want to kind of really lean into a particular policy trajectory. And they may sometimes find the advice from departments wanting. They may find it's not sufficiently creative, and they need to pull in a bunch of ideas. So what's interesting about the housing stuff that you mentioned is that, you know, there's been a number of exercises on the outside world in the last kind of year of stakeholders coming together and putting forward lots of ideas. You can see throughout the housing plan that's been announced and what's in the budget, a bunch of snakes and ladders back to those ideas, where there are ideas that existed on the outside, like the capital cost allowance, for example, that was in the National Housing Accord. And someone in finance thought, hey, that's a really good idea. Experts are telling us this is what we need in order to grow supply. Let's take that proposal and just run it into the budget process. And then you get a bunch of analysts in the Department of Finance to work on it. But the idea doesn't come from the Department of Finance or doesn't come from within government. It comes from outside of government.
This is probably a dumb question, but it's something I've always been curious about. So once the budget is passed, how does the money actually get distributed? You know, if you have a tax change, I get that that is fairly straightforward. But if you are trying to build something new or actually spend that money, how does that work?
So remember that the budget is just one massive Excel sheet, right? And quite literally, your listeners should not be mystified when I say this. It is one massive Excel sheet with a whole bunch of
individual
line item decisions. But that's the point. It's a planning document. There's nothing underlying that Excel sheet that does anything, right? At the end of the day, once the budget speech is delivered and there's a vote on the budget itself, there's a couple of things that have to happen. One is there's implementing legislation that has to come forward, which we call a Budget Implementation Act. And that Budget Implementation Act will have, in some cases, legislation attached to it that implements the ideas of the budget. In some cases, it also has direct statutory appropriations, which means that you can literally say, I want to give X billion dollars to this province for this purpose. And if that legislation passes, the moment it passes and is given royal assent, the government of Canada has the authority to go get cash from the market and give it to that person that they have been given authority to. But in most cases, if you're establishing a new program, the way in which that program will come about is not going to happen necessarily through the Budget Implementation Act. It'll happen in a separate process that we call supply and estimates. And that process is where we go and go department by department on a regularized basis to Parliament and say, I need $20 billion for ESDC. Can I have $20 billion for ESDC, the Department of Employment and Social Development Canada? And Parliament will look over all of the votes associated with each of those decisions, and it will decide, do we want to give $20 billion to ESDC? But before you can get to that moment in time in which there is a decision to ask for that amount of money, Treasury Board has to take all of the things that were approved in the budget process and go back to those departments and say, well, you now have gotten what we call funding authority, and you've potentially also gotten policy authority. Now I have to give you what we call access to funding. And access to funding means that there's an assessment before we go to Parliament to say, are you ready to spend? Do you have a plan as to how you will spend? How are you going to hire people? If you need to do grants and contributions, what does that look like? Do you need to have new terms and conditions for the way your program works? So there's a whole bunch of work behind the scenes to make sure, is this idea ready for prime time? Then we go and get money. Then once we've gotten the money, then departments can actually start to do stuff. And if all of this sounds like it's a bit of a delayed process, it is. It means that any new idea that may have started for the first time in a budget may not actually start to move in the sense of getting people hired and actually doing stuff until 9 or 12 months later, right? Mm. And this can sometimes lead to a mismatch between what we've said we were going to spend in a given period of time and what we actually do. And that mismatch, that delay that happens for all good reasons around accountability, actually is starting to become a bigger problem over time.
That's interesting. I'm curious about, you know, once these programs, let's say 12 months down the road, and the program has been, the expectation is that a new program will have been spun up by that point. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that go into a budget. I'm curious about who is monitoring whether this stuff is actually happening or not. Like if you, Tyler Meredith, are in finance and you oversee this process, and then a year later, are you going back and checking on whether things have happened, or how does that accountability process work?
So I'm not, but the thing called the Treasury Board of Canada is. So Treasury Board is, it serves two functions. One is it's its own department. It's the Treasury Board Secretariat. And its minister responsible is Anita Anand, who's the president of the Treasury Board. But Treasury Board is also a management board. It's a committee of cabinet, and it acts as the management board of government. And so once there have been budget decisions made, it is Treasury Board's responsibility to run what we call the expenditure management system in the government of Canada. And so you can get you get the access to funding, as I mentioned earlier, which gives you the ability or the authority to go to get authorization to spend from Parliament and to appropriate money. And that initial access to funding is really just looking at, have you got all your ducks in a row? Have you thought about all the things you need to do to run your program? Then Treasury Board over time will come back after you've received your appropriation and will administer a kind of an assessment to say, well, how well are you doing relative to what you said you would do? Are you accessing funds on the basis of the conditions that we as Treasury Board and Parliament instituted when we gave you access to funding? And we may, for example, gate access to future funding on the basis of certain milestones that need to be met. And so you may get authority after a first budget to spend in year one and two, but then you've got to come back in year three and year four and demonstrate how well you're doing. And you can imagine, you know, given the Treasury Board is a committee, it's a small number of ministers, it's about four or five ministers of cabinet. They've got a lot of stuff going on, you know, throughout the year in their own departments they're responsible for, let alone sitting on Treasury Board. And Treasury Board has lots of stuff that it's dealing with, right? And you can imagine the mass of departments have to come back all the time, constantly doing a review process. In some ways, it's too much of a process because I think sometimes we may not be able to scratch the surface given the volume of stuff that has to happen in government. But theoretically, that's the process of how we exercise accountability on programs.
Okay. I want to ask you about some of the decision-making that goes into the budget process, because you've been privy to a lot of that. And, you know, we've talked about the governance side, but the budgets are also political in a way. So I'm curious, how do you balance the political demands of a budget with sort of like the long-term imperatives of governing? How do you think about that?
Well, it's challenging, right? Because every budget is its own discrete event in a given moment in time in a year, and stuff is always changing. I mean, I think some people, you know, in an ideal world would think, okay, there's an election that happens, parties put out their platforms, they get, you know, they get elected and they get a confidence from the people as to a mandate to go and do something. And then your job in government is to just go and do that. And that's certainly a part of it, but stuff changes over the course of 4 years, right? The new US president gets elected, geopolitical problems persist, we go into recession, a pandemic happens. And so you can't just kind of develop a budget in year one and develop a policy agenda in year one and just work for the subsequent 3 years on implementation. It's going to have to change because people expect that, right? If we had just been operating on the basis of where we were in 2021, through this mandate, you know, we would have missed, I think, a lot of what's been happening in the affordability crisis in the last couple of years. So the budget, because it is that central planning process of government, has to be the political check on, are we still doing things in a way that people would have confidence in us, right? In the mandate that they gave us and that they want to renew us. And I mean, I think the challenge with the budget process is, even if you do a really good job of keeping up with those priorities, there's just so much stuff in the budget in and of itself that it's very hard for all of that stuff to resonate with people, right? Most people don't know that there's an accelerated capital cost allowance for new housing. Most people don't know that there's also a new investment tax credit, an accelerated capital cost allowance for patents and data infrastructure. Most people may not know that the government is taking action on overdraft fees and NSF fees. People may not know that they're enhancing access to free financial advice. All of those things happened and much, much more in this budget. But probably the one thing that people do know that happened is there might be a tax increase, right? And this is the challenge with budgets, is they get reduced into reduced form of the one or two things that really grab headlines on the day of. And so the increasing challenge for governments in the last number of years has been, how do we go and find people in their unique constituencies and the unique kind of information bubbles of where they exist to get them information about what is happening? So in this budget, you may have noticed that there's been more work done to proactively expand the kinds of people who get invited to budget lockups, to include social media influencers, to include people who run blogs, the kinds of people who would not ordinarily be journalists that you would ordinarily invite to a budget lockup 20 years ago.
Right. So it was a communications exercise in that respect. I guess I have in mind with that question something specifically like housing, where it's clearly such a severe problem from a policy perspective, from an affordability perspective, but it's unclear to me, at least, whether it will any action taken on that now will bear political fruit for years because of the laws of physics, right? It takes time to build buildings. And next year, presumably, will be an election year. So why do you think you would make a decision to focus on housing now rather than something that might, you know, have more clear political benefit in the short term ahead of an election? Like, how does that balance? How do you strike that balance?
So sometimes good politics is as much about having shields as having swords, right? And so you need to be able sometimes to keep people's interest, to get them to listen to you on other things, even if you may not have the ability to fully answer the main problem that they have asked for, which in this case might be housing. It's going to take a long time to solve that problem. They need to know that you're doing lots of stuff and that you've got the right intentions, so that if they give you credit, maybe not to having solved that problem, but to have been seen to be responsive to it, it opens the mind to listen to the government on other things, whether that's climate change or its fiscal policy or how it thinks about kind of the role of government in society. Because if the government is seen as not being sufficiently empathetic on the thing that people have said is the most important right now, which is some version of affordability, cost of living, of which housing is one of the top kind of manifestations of that, even if we can't solve that problem, government has to be seen to be doing something about it, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what's interesting to your question about like how far and how quickly you can show progress on this stuff. I think one of the important decisions that was made in this budget is that it didn't just take on housing the position that the only thing we can and must do is supply oriented. Obviously, that is the biggest portion of the government's housing plan, and it should be. We probably should have some degree of a 80-20 balance or 90-10 balance in favor of the amount of effort, resources, and time we spend on different policy tools, because supply is going to be the most important way that we restore equilibrium to the market. But in the short run, if people are having difficulty with affordability, you kind of also have to look at other measures that help them with the cost of rent, or help them with how to get a down payment formalized more easily, or help them with mortgage costs. And that's why probably one of the most important things that the government did in this budget was it lengthened amortization of mortgages for first-time home buyers. That is obviously only focusing on a segment of people, but that segment of people who are the young kind of millennial Gen Z voters, and aspirational people that this government has said it needs to rebuild its credibility with, that is a measure that if anyone is kind of at the margins able to potentially get into the housing market in the next couple of years, or potentially as interest rates come down, may be able to come off the sidelines, that 30-year change is going to mean potentially $500 less per month that they would need to spend in an average mortgage. That is pretty good. That is something that needed to be front and center. And it's why if you just listen to all of the experts, you might have gotten the wrong mix of policy solutions, at least for the political purposes of what the budget was meant to do.
Right. Okay. Let me ask you about state capacity, because one thing that you'll hear is the government really struggles to do anything that's not just adjusting the tax code or issuing tax credits. And I'm curious whether when you're coming up with the budget, if a lack of state capacity concerns you, does that inform the thought that goes into what you're actually going to do in the budget? Because you're concerned, well, we could have this great idea for a great program, but we are suspicious of how well it will actually be implemented. Is that a legitimate concern, do you think?
So every finance minister and ministry has to, as one of their jobs, be a challenge function on their other colleagues, right? That they wouldn't be doing their job if they weren't suspicious about the ability to do something or to try to find a reason as to not do something. Because at the end of the day, finance ministers, as I said, are judged more or less for themselves at least, on the performance of the fiscal track. And that more or less is usually a cost minimization exercise. So you're going to try to find reasons to say no to things. And a good reason to say no to something is I don't believe that you can do it, or is that, you know, this may not be the most effective means to solve that problem. And oh, by the way, even if it's not the most effective means to solve that problem, we don't have time to come up with another solution, right? So you sometimes look for reasons to defeat something. And that's usually actually a good reason. But I would say particularly at the federal level, when I hear you say state capacity, I also think about, you know, is the federal government, does it have the tools? Does it have the abilities? Does it have the know-how in this space, right?
Yeah.
And housing is a great example of that, because if you go and look at the National Housing Strategy in 2017, it had very lofty goals. It probably actually should have been more ambitious than it was. But one of the challenges that it faced was that it was coming from a time in which the federal government had been actively taking itself out of the housing market, and Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation did not see itself as having a role in affordable housing. And so that meant that when they were asked as an organization to pivot, to give new advice of what should be a national housing strategy in order to, how do you build affordable housing, they kind of had no concept of how to do it because they hadn't done it for 30 years, right? And that's not their fault. That's the fault of having let that muscle memory die in government. But this is the real challenge that we face, is that on some level, governments have to still do stuff because the population elected them to do stuff. And sometimes we kind of have to do things even in a somewhat dumb way, even if we know it may not fully work, because that is democracy. Because people voted for that, they want that, and we will only get better over time if we learn.
Hmm. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. Like, if you stop doing something as a government, you're not going to be good at it, and that becomes a reason not to do it in the future.
Yes.
Okay. I'm only going to ask you one question about the federal budget that we just had, and it's about the capital gains tax changes, because I've seen so much criticism about this, and I think there's a lot of misunderstandings or misapprehensions about what has actually changed. So can you just give us your perspective on these capital gains tax adjustments that we've seen?
Sure. So I think it's first important to note for everybody that 80% of people almost never pay any capital gains ever because they don't invest in or have exposure to tax, what we would consider to be taxable assets. They might invest in an RRSP or a TFSA, or they have a house, all of which are exempt from capital gains because they're treated differently in the tax system, right? And so what we're really talking about is people who make an investment either in a taxable investment account, or they acquire property that is secondary, or they invest in a business, right? And so in any one of those three instances, there are some things that we want out of society for broader economic or societal objectives associated with those investments. So entrepreneurship is one of them, right? And we do need as a country to invest more in supporting new business creation, because we have fewer new businesses being formed over time. That actually is a long-term structural problem for Canada. But a lot of the evidence would suggest, certainly given the degree to which we've created a richer, more generous investment tax regime over time for investments, that those problems like productivity and entrepreneurship have remained problems. And so they've not been solved by this tool, this by making a more generous tax system. And so in an environment where we need more homes, more healthcare, more defense, more action to address climate change, and so on and so forth, government needs certain resources in order to do that. And so increasing the capital gains inclusion rate, which just simply changes the amount of the capital gain that goes back into being treated as income, while providing a lot of other offsets in terms of lifetime capital gains exemption or a $250,000 threshold where nothing below that is ever touched on an annual basis on a personal level, you know, it really means that this thing is centered on a very small subset of people and businesses, let's admit, and businesses who frankly probably have some ability to pay this. Will it affect over time certain investment decisions? Potentially. But as I said, we've gone through 25 years of evidence where we've substantially cut taxes, both in terms of income and investment, and it has not produced anywhere near what we expected in terms of productivity or income growth.
Yeah. Do you buy this argument that, okay, well, yes, all of that might be true, but this is going even on the margins to discourage investment? And, you know, as you said, we already have these problems with growth and productivity, perhaps. So we shouldn't even touch it. Do you buy that case at all?
I could see it potentially affecting a couple of investment decisions, but I think it's important to put this into a larger context, right? Joe Biden, in his budget that he just submitted to Congress and which he will likely run on in this next presidential race, and potentially, if you look at the polls right now, he actually is leading Trump for the first time in a while. He submitted a budget to Congress that called for an increase in the capital gains rate to a rate that would be about 3.5 percentage points higher than what Minister Freeland and the Prime Minister put forward in this budget. So if you're worried about maintaining the competitiveness between Canada and the United States, which is primarily where we compete for access to capital, right, to be able to sustain a healthy, growing entrepreneurial sector, you would look at that and say, well, actually, Joe Biden is going to maintain and enhance Canada's tax advantage, even with these changes that we would have. Now, we'll see whether or not he can get that past the Congress or get elected on it. But my point is, you know, we are at a time in which there is a need to establish a policy agenda of abundance, right? And that abundance agenda, which lots of people who are the same people annoyed by this tax change have called for, it has to be paid for somehow. Right. And there is a certain degree of unfairness that exists in the tax system right now, where somebody who earns, you know, $250,000, actually, sorry, let's say $350,000 entirely in capital gains, their average tax rate today will be about 15%. For somebody who is taking all of that money in salary, they're going to have an average tax rate that's much higher, potentially double, given just that they're going to find themselves even in the top marginal tax rate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for your time. This has been very interesting. And, you know, I feel like I finally understand how the money is getting spent. So I appreciate you explaining it to me.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Well, that's the pod. Thank you so much to Tyler for joining us. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to get more like it, you can subscribe to the show by searching Free Lunch by the Peak wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this, we'd really appreciate it if you leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We'll see you next week.